Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin. Jim Petrosky is out this week. He's at the HART conference. What HART stands for? What, hardened electronics and radiological technologies? I think that's what it stands for.
Something nerdy and geeky like that. Yes.
Yeah. So if you're an engineer and you specialize in hardened electronics against EMP, you're going to be at that conference this week. And that's where Jim is, because that's his specialty. So it's just me and Curtis. And so we thought we'd have a nice, you know, he and I have been talking about doing a, I don't know if we want to call it a podcast or a web show called Scotch and Strategy.
Sit
in our leather chairs with a nice glass of scotch and just, you know, because in the military we have a, you know, like Friday afternoons, a scotch and strategy is kind of a common thing. So we've thought we need to bring that to, you know, Rumble or something. But today we'll have sort of a practice session, even though we're missing the scotch. But, you know, there was a great article that just sort of set your hair on fire. And I thought, oh, geez, whenever I read it, it was a foreign affairs article, Europe's Nuclear Trilemma, the Difficult and Dangerous Options for Post-American Deterrence by Mark Bell and Fabian Hoffman. And it's sort of in the vein of this world is ending, the Americans are out of NATO, and Europe has been left to its own devices. And it appears to sort of take as granted that the Americans are out of NATO. And for you and me, that's sort of one of those things where we're like, when did the Americans leave NATO? You know, the fact that President Trump has said, hey, you got to spend at least 2% and you really should get to 5% of GDP on defense spending doesn't mean the Americans are leaving NATO. And as you know, you've got a copy of President or Marco Rubio, Secretary Rubio's speech that was, you know, in Europe this past week. And he said very clearly, we're not leaving NATO. And in fact, we just had 4 American soldiers die in training exercises in Lithuania. And, you know, we've got bomber rotations and we've got all sorts of stuff going on. And so the U.S. is not, you know, pulling back in an isolationist form such that, you know, we're not going to participate anywhere. So this idea is, it's sort of one that I don't know where people get off sort of assuming it to be true when it's not, even though we're putting pressure on the Europeans to play a bigger role in their own defense. So with that said, what was your take on the article? I mean, I know you had your own thoughts. What were you thinking as you read through it?
Well, thanks, Adam. And it's good to be here. And I hope everybody's going to stick with us, even though Jim's not here today. But, yeah, we'll muddle through. I first want to comment on the sort of the background of this article that you kind of started. I want to add my thoughts to it here. I don't know if there is if this is an act of projection, a sort of wishful thinking. We'd like the Americans to leave NATO. I don't know about Mark Bell, but Fabian Hoffman is a professor at some Norwegian university. So, I mean, he's a European national that is certainly well versed in Euro politics as well as Euro defense, and so. I'm actually quite surprised that someone of his intellect would fall for such silly propaganda as to believe that that President Trump and the Americans are somehow going to pack up their bases and leave. It just isn't happening. It isn't going to happen. It's simply asking for NATO to pay their fair share, if you will. You mentioned Secretary Rubio's statement. I just want to kind of start us off with this. On April 3rd in Belgium, in Brussels, you can even watch this on YouTube. Secretary of State Rubio and Secretary General Rutte of NATO sort of were standing there together, and the ceremonial handshakes and glam and glitter of politics, and taking a few questions and whatnot. But there, Secretary General Rutte mentioned that he had met with President Trump a week or two earlier, and stated that he reminded me that Trump is I'm sorry that that. The United States is a staunch ally to NATO, and for those who are kind of curious, so Secretary Rubio was quite clear on the stage. He said, "President Trump has made clear he supports NATO. We are going to remain in NATO," and he goes on to say he just wants NATO to be stronger. President Trump believes that this is a collection not just of partners and allies, but of advanced economies, of rich countries who are capable to do more. Asking them to prioritize defense over other domestic spending and these sorts of things is not necessarily an unrealistic ask. And then finally, Secretary Rubio kind of walked off the stage with what I thought was a very poignant statement, and that was, quote, "hard power is still necessary as a deterrent," unquote. And so creating that hard power is the necessary challenge here. And the irony about this article written by Hoffman and Bell is that whether they are hoping America will leave NATO, or whether they are projecting some sort of imaginary circumstance, or whether or not they are trying to speak truth to power and create some sort of inevitability, if America leaves, this article analyzes how much more money they're going to have to spend to achieve their own nuclear deterrent. Why not just spend it on NATO and keep the Americans in, right? After all, Adam, wasn't NATO created for three things, right? It was to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in.
Yeah. No, true enough. And, the funny thing is, I think there is a common misunderstanding of why President Trump is doing what he's doing. And I'm not sure if there's a belief that he dislikes Europe, which is not the case. The simple fact is, the United States has a $36 trillion deficit. $36 trillion, that's a lot of money. It's 123% of American GDP. And economists say that once you hit about 70% of GDP to debt ratio, then that has a negative economic consequence. And if you look at Japan is a country that has already gone through this. And Japan never recovered. If you think back to the 1980s, when you and I were younger, and I still have the same amount of hair as I did back then, but we were both younger, and but we thought that we were concerned that Japan was going to eclipse the United States as the most powerful and wealthiest nation in the world. That was what we feared that. And there were movies. I mean, think about Nakatomi Plaza, and we thought that it was Japan that was going to do it, but we found out that Japan was debt laden. And then eventually they had, inflated their currency, and they had made these moves, and then they've never recovered. Japan eventually just sort of has stagnated, and they've been stagnant. And so for the United States, we're approaching the same debt levels that the Japanese had that ultimately caused their stagnation and essentially their fall. And President Trump does not want that to happen in the United States. So what is he doing? He's trying to control debt. He wants to balance the budget. Well, how do you balance a budget? Well, for the United States, we spend $4 trillion of the $4.9 trillion we took in revenue. $4 trillion is spent on welfare and entitlement programs. The other $900 billion is spent on paying the interest. That's 100% of all federal revenue is spent between entitlements and debt. 100%. So the State Department, Commerce Department, Defense Department, all that other stuff, that's all money that has to be borrowed to pay for that. And so Trump has said, hey, we can't keep doing that. You can't borrow $2 trillion a year. You will end up a broke and stagnant country like Japan. So what does he have to do? Well, he has to cut domestic spending. He has to shrink the size of government. And then he has to tell other countries, hey, listen, we've been the single largest funder of your defense for the last 70 years, right? We won the war for you. Then we rebuilt your countries. Now we've allowed your countries to have unfair trade agreements. Because if you go look at tariffs for Europe relative to the U.S. has always allowed European goods to be imported in the United States at much lower tariff rates than when we try to export to Europe. And for example, the French created, because they didn't want to have tariff problems, they created unloading docks to where U.S. cars couldn't come off of ships. And so they made their docks to unload to where U.S. vehicles couldn't come off of ships. So the U.S. couldn't export cars to France. And the Europeans have done these kinds of things for 7 decades, and we've tolerated it. And so finally, President Trump has said, hey, listen, we're at a point where we can't do that anymore. We've long been that friend of yours who always bought the beer at the bar. And we just don't have the money to buy you round after round anymore. We're not in that position. So now you're going to have to buy rounds. And that's really the position we're in. And it's not a, we hate you. We don't want nothing to do with you, but it's a, hey, we're going to have to act as equals here. And that means you're going to have to, you know, we're not going to subsidize your welfare states, which the United States has. Remember, their economies don't grow. European economies grew at 0.4% last year. And the reason they don't grow is because large welfare state economies don't grow. Welfare states don't grow economies. They don't. They cause stagnation. That's why communism never worked, because economies don't grow in them. And so the simple fact is Donald Trump has said that because of our domestic economic issues, you're going to have to start acting more autonomously and kicking in. We'll still be there as one of, 31 member countries, and we'll still be the most powerful. 32, we'll still be the most powerful one, but we're not going to be the overwhelming country that we once were in terms of defending you. And that should be something that Europeans can understand and sympathize with, that we want fair trade policies, that we want them to spend their own money on their own defense, and that the United States will be a good partner, but a partner who wants you to pick up some of the slack. So therefore, when these guys write this article as if the U.S. has pulled out, I think it's not instructive of what's actually going on in the U.S. and in the Trump administration.
So, well, I think you're right. And to go to the next step, when we look at, I know we've done podcasts on this in the past, but on what NATO does to participate here in 2024, only 8 of the 32 nations still aren't making the 2%. So, I guess that's a good number in comparison to what it was. But just a little while prior to 2024. 22 of the 32 nations weren't making the 2%. Do you know what year that was?
What's that?
2023.
Oh, yeah.
So to get to 8, it only got there in 2024. And so when you think about this, The Ukrainian war had already been going on for 2 years before, two-thirds of NATO decided to get to the 2% that they promised they would do back in, 2006, I think, was the first time they decided to get to 2%. And so I think this is problematic. And when we look at, just to give you an idea, who are the countries that just got there in 2024? I'll start from the little ones: Montenegro, North Macedonia, Albania, Bulgaria, Slovak Republic, Czech Republic, Romania, Denmark. We'll come back to Denmark in a moment. Norway, Sweden, which, you know, is a brand new NATO country, of course. The Netherlands, Turkey wasn't paying 2% at 2023. And here are the last shockers: Germany and France. Now, the premise of Professor Hoffman and Mr. Bell's article is that they're going to rely on France and Britain to pony up nuclear capability in order to do the nuclear mission for Europe, assuming America has left NATO. I think that's a bit of a problem here when you're looking at a nation that has been supporting NATO for 70 plus years. And now you're going to say, oh, but the one country that just came back to NATO in 2009 and has only made the 2% requirement in 2024, they'll take care of us. We're good. And we're going to change the decision cycle from President Trump or Biden or Trump or Obama or Bush and so forth and so forth. We're going to give that requirement to President Macron whichever British prime minister is in office this year. So I would say there's some challenge here when you look at this both politically, historically, and then, of course, militarily. What do they have to bring to the table is largely 8 boomer submarines, right? And so how many of
and
them
we saw at sea we at saw this time? Week we saw this week that the British just announced that they made it public that they're finding all sorts of Russian gear.
Yes.
Along the coast, you know, off of Faslane.
Sensor gear.
Because the Russians, this idea that boomers, for the American disarmament community that wants nothing but boomers, that would be a terrible idea because boomers can be tracked and they're really, really susceptible entering and leaving port and in port. Right. And the British just admitted this is what was happening to them.
That's right. And then they had some launch failures last year in some tests on their new submarines or their refurbished maintenance submarines. So there's some real challenges here as to what they want to do. And so we can go over, I think, what the three options that the article brings up, which I think is pretty interesting how the authors thought through this problem in a Venn diagram format.
It's pretty good. What they say is pretty good. You know, there are three options, you know. So basically, their three options are European, and I'm going to quote here, European leaders have three goals they would like to achieve: credible and effective deterrence against Russia, strategic stability, and non-proliferation of nuclear weapons to new states. And so their options that you'll talk about are built around this. And I would submit to you that what they say is pretty good if you assume the Americans are out. That's the fundamental thing that I disagree with, is that there's nothing to say the Americans are out. What the Americans are saying is it's your turn to buy beer at the bar too.
That's right.
We won't buy all the rounds.
I agree. And what's interesting is the authors say you can't do all three. You can only do two of them, and it'll be at the expense of the third. And so as he does his analysis, which I think is actually pretty well done, and I really enjoyed reading through and thinking about how they thought about it. And essentially, I come up with a different answer than they do using their formula. But nonetheless, they say, well, if you do the credibility, I'm sorry, if you do the strategy and non-proliferation two circles of the Venn diagram, then you're going to have a credibility gap because now you're limited only to the second strike of France and Ukraine and the United Kingdom. That's it, right? Because you're also non-proliferating, so no one else can have nukes. And they're in this scenario, you're asking not only to depend on France and UK, and they have to change their doctrine and whatnot, but they're asking that they would have to have more. So they'd have to buy more nukes, buy different kinds of nukes, because the credibility means you've got to have a willingness to at least threaten a first strike.
You know what's funny, though?
The second? Yeah.
So before you move on, whenever I read that,
yeah,
this idea that the French and the UK, so there's only one country in the European Union or in NATO that redistributes more money than the United States. We redistribute 29.7% of all GDP. One out of every $3 made in the U.S. get redistributed to somebody who didn't earn it.
Okay.
There's one country that does more. Which one do you think it is? It's France. A NATO member state. France. France does 30.4%.
Yeah, there you go.
So now I was watching a few days ago a BBC documentary. And remember, the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, is a, you know, it's a state-owned entity like National Public or, you know, NPR.
Yeah.
And it was a documentary about a Moroccan immigrant to the UK who had three wives and 12 children. And the documentary was about how hard it was for him. And two of his wives are in the UK and one of them's back in Morocco. And it was how hard it was for him to give his three families, because he's on welfare, to give all three of his families the life they deserve. And that the British government doesn't give him enough money to go back to Morocco regularly to visit his third family. And I thought, if this is how the British government spends its money, mm-hmm. and they're making documentaries to look for sympathy for this guy, then they're not going to have the kinds of funding that it takes to expand their nuclear arsenal and to, you know, move it to other European nations and do all the things that it takes. That's just not how there's, right. I mean, look at, right. I mean, this documentary was sort of the epitome of why it's so hard for Europe to defend itself, because this sort of stuff is repeated in country after country after country.
Right.
So and go ahead.
To be fair, the Brits were also up until 2021, April of 2021, they were on a pretty steep glide slope to eliminating warheads and drawing down on their nuclear capability. My prediction prior to 2021 was that they would be the first country to maybe renounce their nuclear capability. But in 2021, they changed their minds, reassessed the strategic environment, and made a decision to begin re-adding warheads to their credit. So that's good. So we go on to the second option that the authors came up with, which was use the credibility and effectiveness circle combined with the non-proliferation circle, which would now be what they felt was destabilizing. So because you'd still be limited only to France and the UK, but you would need to have this enhanced sort of first strike capability. You'd have to have this real expanded capability of lower yield type of things, because you've got to have the credibility to get there. So now you introduce this first strike, not just a reliable second strike that the first option was, but now you've got to have some warfighting capability if you want to make the threat. And so, but the authors believe that would be would be destabilizing and threatening, if you will, to the Russians and these sorts of things. And we look at what is stabilizing, Adam. I mean, it's really there's no universal definition to what strategic stability or global stability is. And the best way to look at that or assess it is it's really what the two parties, the good guys and the bad guys, if for lack of a better term, what they agree upon is stable and not stable.
No. Listen, stability is defined as whatever I think it is. And if you're doing something different, then that's inherently destabilizing. So to all of those who disagree with me, whatever you support is destabilizing. I don't care what it
is.
That's
right.
It's destabilizing because I disagree. And that's correct. The definition of it.
In American politics, so if Professor Hoffman's listening to us, in American politics, if the Russians are doing it, it's okay. If the Americans attempt to match it or do something similar, that is destabilizing. So that is a good way for you to understand what is destabilizing in most of America's perspective here. I kid just a little bit. All right. So let's go on to the third option here. And the third option was the credibility and effective, credible and effective arsenal and strategic stability. This comes at the expense of nonproliferation. And so in this scenario, you essentially assume all the nukes, low-yield nukes, more capability, all of that stuff, and for the credibility. And we're going to allow other responsible states who have the capability and desire to nuke up to nuke up. And the authors sort of lay out that they would actually set rules for this, and that these rules would be limited to that only the nations who were most at risk would be allowed. So Portugal would probably not be allowed to be a nuclear power, but maybe Poland and the Baltics might. Because they're closer to the fight, if you will. And, strategists and tacticians can agree to disagree on these sorts of things. Do you really want to put your weapons closer to the enemy? These sorts of things. But
there's one big caveat you haven't mentioned. Whether this happens or not all depends on whether the Russians let it.
Well,
it's all about do the Russians accede to it.
Yeah, that well, that is correct, these are the challenges, and let's not forget, the European culture. There's no doubt they can afford doing these ideas, any one of them, if it's a priority for them. I talk about that on America's perspective all the time, but there's a culture that just does fundamentally. In Europe is just not interested in getting engaged in these sorts of issues in most, certainly the what we would call old Western Europe. New Eastern Europe, they might be a little more. Poland, for example, I think is ready to be a nuclear power, wants to be a nuclear power, judging from some of the statements and inferences from their leadership. They are certainly spending the money to make sure they're not interested in being under the boot of Russia ever again. I think they are willing. Go ahead.
Let's not forget for the Poles. The Poles have been partitioned. And by partition, I mean they've ceased to exist as a nation. That's happened to them twice. And it was by the Russians and the Germans. The Russians and the Germans love to, make Poland go away as a country. And so the Poles rightfully are scared and they're fearful. And therefore they're spending 4.13% of their GDP on defense. And remember, why do the Russians invade West? It's because they want, room to fall back across the great European plain. And what's that country that's sort of the big flat area right in the middle? That's Poland. And so the Poles rightfully understand the difficult position that they've been in. Let's not forget the last time the Russians were in Poland, they took all the Polish officers and shot them and buried them in giant pits. So the Poles have bad memories of the Russians, you know, it, rightfully so. So, you know, this idea that the Balts.
So I would say here that so the author decides that the best scenario of the three is the credibility and non-proliferation circles, and they are going to assume the risk that they won't destabilize the situation, and so because the thing here is the authors make a great statement here that I completely agree with, and I want to share with the listeners, and that is that the danger of sacrificing credible deterrence is that Europe would be left to rely on Russian restraint. And this is a key thought, and this is true of anybody who is a believer in deterrence. We cannot assume that the Russians would be restrained at all. And I think during the Cold War, we erroneously hoped that we could convince them to be to restrain. If you know, you can go on open source and look at the old Secretary of Defense reports to Congress in the 1980s, and there are open statements from the Secretaries of Defense under Reagan stating that they were going to pursue a specific targeting regime, and I'm quoting, in the hopes that the Russians will follow and not target America's cities. So there was a lot of this sort of idea that we have to bank a little on Russian restraint. And I'm for one, don't believe that the Russians are at all interested in saving American lives over Russian lives, or Western European lives, for that matter, over Russian lives. And so I think that's interesting. I think, though, that in a Europe that is as chaotic as it is right now, and would be if America wasn't there, I think the chaos would be much larger. I think maybe you would agree. Accepting a version of this that is more destabilizing may not necessarily be the right answer. So I disagree with our author's decision on what the best one is, and I'm happy to give you mine of what I think the best one of the three is. And that is the credibility and the stability scenario. Let's not let idealism, right, stop nuclear participation. This idea that that the West is more virtuous by somehow ensuring that no more countries proliferate and become nuclear powers is, I just think, is inappropriate for this decade and the next. You cannot continue to restrain countries who may feel this to be an issue with their own security. We're seeing rumblings about this in Korea, of course, and Poland, and in other areas of the world. The likelihood that another nuclear country, that one more, not one less, is going to happen in the next 10 to 15 years, I think, is real. And so the question then is, the best thing you can do is, if there's going to be proliferation, try to control it and try to make it work to your benefit. And so my advice to those who are strategizing with Hoffman and Bell is to select your countries in Europe that are willing to proliferate, or what we here at NIDS call participate, and perhaps get them to pony up resources and doctrine and capability, and allow more NATO countries to be nuclear powers. And then this, I think, is more stabilizing in that sense. So you garner stability, you garner credibility, and non-proliferation is purely an idealistic decision not to proliferate. And for a nation that feels like they should and could and would have nuclear weapons, there's, in their minds, that's probably not the right answer to keep them from doing it. So I think the answer is on the table there, and that's where I would go. And I would like to add lastly here is, the authors really bank on the idea that capability and numbers matter. And what's interesting is if you remove the American deterrent, you shrink the European deterrent down to hundreds, not thousands, hundreds of warheads. And that if you think that that's enough to deter Russia, who will have thousands, has thousands, and probably has many more thousands, then you were still creating a destabilized scenario simply by the fact that you are not balanced in any shape or form or have achieved any sort of parity that would, I think, contribute to stability. And so that matters. And so I think we got they showed a little ankle in this in this article in sort of coming to our side as they went through the decision process in this article. And I found that to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that the Europeans have sort of adopted that Mohandas Gandhi was right. Nonviolence is the best approach. And, you know, the Russians will respond the way that the British Empire responded to Gandhi. You know, I don't think the Russians are going to respond to a European hunger strike sort of the way, you know, that the Empire, the British Empire responded. So, you know, they're going to have to go back to their roots. And the Europeans were really, really, really good at violence. They were exceptionally good at it. And they're going to have to relearn it, right? I mean, who was the biggest slavers in the world 1,000 years ago? It was the Vikings. And so, you know, they were good at invading and killing and stealing. And so those Europeans need to tap into, right. Well, I mean, they wanted their land back. Right. So, you know, they need to tap into their historical violent roots and, you know, understand that, you know, militaries matter and that it's time to, you know, rebuild them.
Do you think the real risk in all of this to the Russians is that if the Americans leave NATO, that the Euros will become this sort of proactive force in what you're just describing here? When we think about, you know, the various wars that occurred in Europe, the great power wars that occurred in Europe in the past centuries with Napoleon and Hitler and so forth, the Kaiser and the ability for
the hundred years
for
war,
European nations. Yeah.
I mean, you go back.
Yeah.
The Europeans fight, or historically the Europeans have fought a lot. And that's sort of what the Americans have been able to do over the last 70 years is to make the Europeans. And it sort of worked too well. It's kind of worked too well, and that they've now become this, go ahead.
Yeah, I think to some degree, nuclear deterrence and American leadership in NATO has pacified Europe. You know, Putin is he's a historical guy. He looks at history all the time. We may not always agree in how he's interpreting history, but he looks at history, Russian history and European history writ large. You know, he did that interview a year or two ago with Tucker Carlson. And I mean, he was quoting history, you know, for 35 minutes and going through Russian history, wars with Sweden and so forth. And my suspicion is that, you know, Putin's number one strategic threat is NATO. And yes, NATO includes the United States and will continue to include the United States. But he doesn't actually say the United States. He says NATO. And so, you know, we have to think about this here. And as NATO builds up, the EU president just spoke a week or two ago about Europe's going to go under $1 trillion rearmament spending spree. The SHAPE EUCOM commander testified before Congress here a week or two ago, and he said the problem anymore isn't money anymore. It's that they can't spend it fast enough. There's nothing to buy because the defense industrial base isn't prepared to take in all of those orders, whether it be American or European. And so this is a big challenge. We've got people and nations that want and need to spend money to buy military equipment, and no one has the industrial base to do it.
Yeah, no, I'm with
you. These are real big challenges, and so I think there's I think there's going to be some pretty interesting things here. But for those of you out there who continue to write articles and pontificate about President Trump and the United States leaving NATO, you need to just stop that. It's not happening. And frankly, it looks silly.
It's not helpful, and it doesn't really add to the analysis because it's just not happening. So
it doesn't.
All right. Well, great discussion. We've gone a little long, but hopefully you, the listeners, have hung in there with us. Of course, I always want to remind you, check us out on Global Security Review. Curtis, he posts a lot of good articles on the Twitter feed every morning. So go check those out. We're working on some new studies that probably in the next 2 or 3 months, we've got some new studies that'll be coming out. So stay there. And of course, since we're talking about Europe, Barcelona, at the time we're recording this, Barcelona won its Champions League semifinal game. So that was big. We got the Champions League going, so make sure you're paying attention to that if you're a football fan.
That's right. And those of you who are actually watching this presentation on Rumble or YouTube, you'll see that Adam is wearing his Barcelona jersey.
Of course, Curtis, thanks for having a good discussion. Enjoyed it. Thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode. And of course, we'll see you next time. And always remember to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.